Let's begin with a short glance meditation again on the Heart Sutra and try to reflect on the meaning of the words of the Heart Sutra, at least the sections that we've covered so far. So as always, we begin by preparing the body, setting it into a state of ease and relaxation. While keeping the back nice and straight, allowing the body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. And preparing the mind, setting it in a state of ease and relaxation. Letting go of any thoughts of the past or the future. And simply allowing the mind to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath, throughout the body. And then as I read through the Heart Sutra slowly, you can contemplate the meaning of the words and allow the words themselves to penetrate deeper into your mind. The heart of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, Arya Bhagavati Prajna Paramita Hridaya Sutra. Thus did I hear at one time. The Bhagavan was dwelling on massive Vultures Mountain in Rajgir, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Then, through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara: how should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Sharadvatriputra: Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this. Correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness. Without characteristic. Unproduced, unceased. Stainless, not without stain. Not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness. No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. No visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no eye element and so on, up to and including no mind element, and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to and including no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom. The mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly, completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as truth, since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared, Tayata, Om, Gate, Gate, Paragati, Parasamgate, Bodhisvaha. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage. It is like that. It is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom, just as you have indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan having thus spoken, the Venerable Sharadvatriputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, those surrounding in their entirety, along with the world of gods, humans, asuras and gandhavas, were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest in its own place. Simply resting in awareness itself. Open and spacious. Relaxed and alert. So let's continue on where we left off before lunch. And we were looking in this section related to the path of meditation. Particularly, we're looking at the sentence that said, there is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to and including no aging and death and no extinction of aging and death. And this sentence, of course, is related to the what's called the 12 links of dependent origination, which are symbolized here in this Bhava Chakra Wheel of Life diagram. And so I think we've covered most of the diagram except the 12 links now. So let's begin to look at these 12 links. So these are, of course, these 12 diagrams around the outside. And if we just read a little bit what says across the page about the 12 links, it says the outer circle of the wheel depicts in clockwise sequence 12 metaphorical images of the 12 links of dependent origination. The 12 links in the chain of dependent arising is one of the most important doctrines in the Buddhist view of causation and interdependence, showing how suffering arises from ignorance and its motivational actions. So let's have a look at these 12 diagrams and see how they sort of fit together and what their significance is. So up the top at about 1 o'clock, of course, we see a person with a stick. This, of course, is a blind person not seeing where they're going. So, of course, that is symbolizing ignorance. We are blinded by ignorance, which means we don't see where we're going in terms of our behavior and our mental attitudes as well, of course. So, of course, this fundamental ignorance, and link one here, of course, is really talking about the specific ignorance of grasping onto independent me, independent objective world, this self-grasping mind. And of course, through that ignorance, we saw that that is leading to the mental afflictions, in particular, initially to the attachment aversion and then all of the other mental afflictions coming out of that. And this is what is driving our behavior. And so the second link is symbolizing these actions motivated by the mental afflictions. So here the second link is translated here as conditioned or formative actions. And it's symbolized here by a person on a potter's wheel forming a pot with the wet clay. Because it's our actions that are really going to determine what our future is going to look like. So hence the person forming the pot from the wet clay. And we can talk about, of course, every action having some result or consequence. But in these 12 links, we are talking about a specific action that will lead to another life. So here then we're really talking about those actions which will lead to another life. So those, like all actions of course we do, leave an imprint on the mind. And so the mind, the third link here is translated as consciousness, so here consciousness just means mind, is symbolized by this monkey jumping between windows and a door. So that should be behind the monkey a house with 5 windows and a door, symbolizing the 5 sense faculties, the windows, and the door is the mental faculty. Meaning we are constantly jumping between the senses, between our thoughts, visual, sound, thoughts. We're jumping all over the place, attracted by various things. Mental and sensory. And so sometimes you hear the expression crazy monkey mind. So I think that's sort of indicating a little bit here, the third link. So of course those actions we do leave those imprints on the mind, and the mind is a continuum of consciousness, and so those imprints are carried along that continuum of mind. And then of course we are, again, here in the 12 links, specifically talking about an imprint that will lead to a new life. And, of course, a new life begins, and we're using, in this example, these 12 links, we're using the example of a human life. The new life begins when the mind conjoins with the fertilized egg in the womb. And so that is link number 4 here, which says name and form. Name and form. So name and form, name here is mind and form is body, body and mind. And so that is symbolized here by some people in a boat. The boat, of course, is the body. So, of course, the boat is the vessel. So our body is the vessel for our mind. And so the people in the boat are the mind. And sometimes you see 2, 3, even sometimes 4 people in the boat. Meaning, again, the mind can be divided up into 2, 3, 4. Many different ways the mind can be divided up. But collectively, all the people in the boat is the mind. So then, of course, that embryo starts to develop, fetus develops, and then some point in the development of the fetus, the sensory faculties become fully developed and operational. And so that is link number 5 here, the 6 sense spheres, which again should be a picture of a house, a drawing of a house with 5 windows and a door. Again, the 5 windows are the 5 sense faculties and the door is the mental faculty. And of course, when the sense faculties become operational, then they contact their respective objects. And so that is link number 6 of contact, symbolizing the contact between the sense faculty and its respective object. And so again, this is symbolized very graphically here by a couple making love. So a lot of contact happening there. So of course, when the sense faculty contacts the object, then we experience the object. And when we experience the object, we experience it as either being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, which, of course, is the mental factor of feeling. So from contact then arises feeling here. So feeling is linked 7, which again here is graphically depicted by a person with an arrow stuck in their eye. So there's a lot of feeling going on there. And then as we saw, our feelings, our pleasant and unpleasant feelings are leading to attachment and aversion. But again, then link 8 and 9 are talking about a specific type of attachment. It's talking about what occurs as we're approaching death. Is that as we are going through the death process, then we are craving and grasping to life itself. And so those are these 2 links here. Link 8 is craving, and this is symbolized by a person with alcohol, so they're craving alcohol. And then link 9 is grasping, and this is again symbolized by a monkey grasping fruit in a tree. So the difference between craving and grasping is that first we start to crave something and then we actually try to get it, try to actually grasp it. So the grasping follows on from the craving. And as I said, these 2 links of craving and grasping are, in these 12 links, are a specific type of craving and grasping. They are what is happening as we go through the death process. And that is, as we go through the death process and we feel like we're going out of existence, we're craving and grasping to life itself. And so that craving and grasping to life itself causes an imprint to be activated in our mind, a karmic imprint to be activated. And so that activated imprint is link number 10 here, which is called becoming. And this, again, is very graphically symbolized by a pregnant woman about to give birth. So that activated imprint is about to give birth to another life. And, of course, then When that activated imprint gives birth to another life, then that life has three phases of birth, aging, and death. And so the first part of birth is link number 11, which is here again symbolized very graphically by a woman actually giving birth. And then link 11, following birth, of course, comes aging and death. And so that is link 12. And here this is graphically again depicted by an old person carrying a sack on their back, and in the sack is a corpse, a dead person. So that's aging and death. So what we can understand from these 12 links is how we are stuck in samsara, in this cycle of birth, aging, and death. So if we go sort of backwards from link 12 to link 1, then we can see that what is the underlying cause of birth, aging, and death is ignorance. Ignorance leads to our actions and so on around to birth, aging, and death. So therefore, we can see how we are trapped in samsara by going through these 12 links. But of course, also we can see how to break free of it, meaning that if we, how to get free of aging and death is we have to stop birth. To stop birth, we have to stop becoming. So we can keep going back until we understand we have to get rid of, extinguish ignorance. So therefore, in the Heart Sutra, when it talks about, it says there is no ignorance and no extinction of ignorance, then it's talking about these two, the forward and the reverse process of these 12 links in terms of how we are stuck in samsara, but also how to break free of samsara. If we take the reverse order, we can understand how to break free of samsara. And so that's what's called the forward and the reverse cycles of the 12 links. And that is what is described here in no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, so on up to and including no aging and death and no extinction of aging and death. So it's talking about both of those cycles, the forward cycle and the reverse cycle, in terms of how we are stuck in samsara and how to break free of samsara. Any questions on these 12 links? Because I want to go into them in a little bit more detail. But first, any questions about the individual links? In the...
But the craving and grasping you mentioned is what is happening in the death process.
As we're approaching death, in these 12 links. Of course, there's craving and grasping always. But in the 12 links, the craving and grasping here are the ones that are occurring at the time of death.
Not in serial.
Well, that's what I'm going to talk about now, is how these 12 fit together. Yeah, it's not as simple as what we've seen here. But first, if there's any questions about any of the individual links, to clarify what they are, and then we're going to look at how these all sort of fit together in more detail.
Sort of similar question to his. Craving and grasping as we approach death, can we consider that from the moment of birth we're approaching death?
Of course we can talk about that, but that's not really talking about these two links. Because what we're talking about here is the process of how an imprint is activated to determine the next life. And so those two links are describing that. Craving, grasping, or attachment. Aversion. But again, we're not talking about, see, we're only talking about a specific occurrence now of as we're going through the death process. Of course, in everyday life, when we have pleasant, unpleasant feelings, we get attachment and aversion. Of course, there's that. But here, we're in this part of the cycle, we're only looking at a particular point of our life as we're approaching death.
So that every moment of attachment to a pleasant sensation or aversion to an unpleasant sensation, a set of links have been set into motion?
No. Again, here, of course, every action we do has an imprint and has a result, but as we're going to see when I go into more detail now, is this 12 links are only really describing how we perpetuate the cycle, life after life. It's not describing in detail every single little action we do and what results from that. This is not really described in here.
And just a question, that doesn't mean that we're going this way, we can go in different way?
I think that's going to be answered now in my more extensive presentation. Yeah. Is there any questions about any of the individual 12 diagrams?
The second one was, you explained it as the conception process.
Sorry?
Formative action.
The second one is our actions that are driven by our mental affliction. So here it's called in Sanskrit samskara karma. Yeah. So the samskaras are mental afflictions and karma is actions. So of course every action we do with motivation leaves an imprint in the mind. But again, here in these 12 links, we're only really looking at those imprints that are going to lead to another life.
I don't know how to ask it, but maybe it sounds like one way to get out of this cycle is trying to have the last imprint in this life to be virtuous or not to be attached to this life.
When we look at this, the craving and grasping and then the activated imprint, then there is an explanation about, well, craving and grasping, which imprint does it activate? And there are many factors that will contribute to determine which imprint gets activated. But if we keep it simple, what we can generally say is the heaviest imprint will get activated.
Ignorance?
No, ignorance is not an imprint. So we're talking about imprints of actions. Yeah. So what we're talking about here is these imprints are imprints of actions. So we do virtuous and non-virtuous actions. Each one of those leaves an imprint in our mind. That's called a karmic imprint. So that's what we're talking about here in terms of imprints. We're not talking about seeds of afflictions or stains of afflictions. Imprints here, we're talking about the imprint of some action that we've done, whether it be virtuous or non-virtuous. And, of course, we do many virtuous and non-virtuous actions, so they're, you know, our mind literally has millions of imprints. So which one of those ripens at the time of death? Again, if we keep it simple, we can say the heaviest one. So what makes something heavy? Again, many factors, but again, if we keep it simple, intention or motivation. So if we do a virtuous or non-virtuous action with a huge motivation, a big motivation, that gives a heavy imprint. For example, if we harm someone with a very strong motivation of hatred and wanting to even kill them or really give them serious harm, that will give a heavy imprint, as opposed to just sort of getting a little bit upset with them and just bumping them or something on the shoulder. That would be very something insignificant compared to that. Same on the positive side. If we do an action of giving some material thing to a person with the motivation of, if I do this, people will think I'm someone special, I'm a good person, versus doing exactly the same act with a motivation that by me doing this, may this act as a cause for me to achieve enlightenment, to help liberate everyone from samsara, that second action will create a much heavier imprint than the action of, I'm doing this so people will think I'm someone good. So again, the key element with all of our actions is our intention, our motivation. Of course, it's not the only factor. We can have a very good intention and create a lot of suffering. So the wisdom has to come with it. But in general, the intention is key. So then, of course, on top of that, so what we're trying to do then, based on this, is really avoid any heavy negative intentions. And we're trying to increase the positive intention. That's why this idea of bodhicitta can really be beneficial, is that when we have that such a vast intention, it means that all of our actions have a lot of weight. Yeah? Have a lot of weight. Of course, if we think, oh, therefore if I have a bodhicitta intention, I'm going to have bigger imprints, I'm going to get better results. If we have that motivation, then we're corrupting it. Then it becomes selfishness again. So remember I talked about the three versions of bodhicitta, the king-like, the boat-like, and the shepherd-like. So if we really have the shepherd-like attitude, that will create the biggest imprints. Yeah? So that's what we need to be trying to do. And then on top of that, of course, is when we do an action and that leaves that imprint with a certain weight to it, then that imprint will probably not stay as that heaviness during our life, because we can affect that imprint in our life. We can make it heavier, or we can make it lighter, or even get rid of it. So that's where the whole idea of if we rejoice in good things, they become heavier. That's where rejoicing is helpful. If we regret our negative actions, that weakens and damages the imprints. It makes them weaker. And so, therefore, and of course also if we do good things, that weakens the negative, the opposite. So that's the whole idea of purification, and then also rejoicing in the good things we do. And so therefore, again, to keep it simple, at the end of our life, you know, we have this sort of like it's a little bit like a balance scale of good imprints and negative imprints. And so the balance scale, if we've done a lot of good in our life and tried not to do any harm and really regretted any harm we've done, then the weight of the good imprints is the heaviest. One of those will ripen and we'll end up in a good place. You know, these white existences. That's where the white side of the diagram comes in. And negative, the black. If negative actions is collectively heavy, one of those will ripen, one of the black actions, and we'll end up in not a good place. So that's to keep it simple.
Just one. That means that it's not a matter of the amount of action that we're doing, but the motivation.
Well, both, isn't it?
It could be that we have one action that was motivated with a very non-virtuous action, motivation, versus like many, many virtuous actions. But that motivation was very, very harmful, you know, selfish.
Oh, then yes.
That could be like...
balanced. I mean, if you do one really heavy negative thing intentionally, and you do lots of positive things with not a very strong motivation, many of them, maybe they balance. Yes, possible. So again, the key element in all of our behavior is our intention. It's not so much what we do, but it's the intention behind it. Of course, not just. I mean, you have to put wisdom with that as well. You know, otherwise, you can have a very good intention and, you know, think that, oh, I want to save the world, so I have to kill all these bad people here. So that's, of course, not going to lead to a lot of good imprints, you know.
Diagram imply that you can't virtue your way out of samsara?
Yes, that's right. Exactly. And that's what we find is that that is the implication, in fact, is that the only way out of samsara is wisdom. And that's what we find, like, within the spiritual Mahayana path, as it is sort of presented in this Geluk school of Tibetan Buddhism, this is exactly what you find. Is it like, how can we make our human life meaningful? And it's presented sort of at three stages or three levels. So the minimum way we can make our life meaningful is exactly this, do good things. Because at least if we do good things, we're going to end up in a good future. Still in samsara, but we'll continue to have a good future. So that's the minimum thing we can do. Because anything less than that, we do harmful things and we're having a lot of suffering. So the minimum way we can make our life meaningful is virtue. But again, then when we do that, then we can understand we're not going to be able to virtue our way out of samsara. We're still stuck. So the next level is to get ourselves out of samsara, meaning we, on top of the virtue, we need to do the wisdom. We need to come to realize nature of reality to get out of samsara. So that's the next level of making our life meaningful. But then we can understand, well, and that's sort of more or less the Theravada level, you know, to get to liberation from samsara. But then we can understand, well, okay, that's very good, better than just doing virtue, virtue plus wisdom better. Then we can say, well, okay, but I'm not the only one stuck in samsara, everyone else is. So let's take it to the next level of striving for enlightenment so I can help liberate everyone else from samsara. So that's the Mahayana level. So that's the sort of the third level. But then we can actually go one more than that and go, okay, in the Mahayana, I'm striving for enlightenment, you know, the bodhicitta aspiration, but, you know, it could take quite some time, many lives to get there. So let's do whatever I can as quick as far as possible so I can get to enlightenment as quick as possible. That's Vajrayana. That's Tantra. So these are the levels. So what we can understand is then that, you know, these are not like choices, you know, or shall I do just the Theravada, the Mahayana, Vajrayana? Theravada, Mahayana, I don't like the look of that. I want the Vajrayana way. Give me that. Well, this is complete, it's levels. You have to go through those levels. Yeah. Otherwise, it's trying to do Vajrayana or Tantra without the basis is crazy. Because, you know, particularly the basis of virtue. I mean, that's, the ethics is the basis of everything. So if you're trying to do Tantra Vajrayana and you're harming people and that, I mean, this is completely, you miss the point. Okay. So let's now look at these 12 links in a little bit more detail. Because I really like these 12 links. I find them very helpful. And if you really can get a very good explanation of this extensive, then it'd be worthwhile. I'm just going to give quite a brief one now. There's also at least one book I know from His Holiness Dalai Lama called The Meaning of Life, which talks about these 12 links. So if you want to at least read that, that could be useful. So remember we said that these 12 links are showing us how the forward order is showing us how we are stuck in samsara. And so remember when we talk about being stuck in samsara, we're really talking about the first two noble truths. The truth of dukkha, which is the state we find ourselves in. Where does that come from? The truth of the cause of suffering, the second noble truth. So if we look at the noble truths then and see how we can map the two first noble truths onto these 12 links, we have, of course, in the second noble truth, what is the underlying cause is ignorance. But there we can, in the Mahayana, in the second noble truth, we can sort of group that together as the mental afflictions. Which our mental afflictions, of course, the root of those is ignorance and then the attachment, aversion and so forth. They are driving our behavior. And so, of course, our behavior is our actions or karma. And that is leading to our experiences, which, of course, is the first noble truth of dukkha. All of our experiences are described as dukkha. So, of course, this is the second noble truth, and this is the first noble truth. Yeah. So, based on that, these 12 links should fit into these three categories. So which of these links are mental afflictions of the 12? Which ones? Anyone? Which of the 12? Yeah. Craving, grasping, number 8 and 9. What else? There's one more. What about the first link, ignorance? It might be useful. So 1, 8, and 9 is the mental afflictions. Karma, which links? 2. Any other link? What about number 10? Wasn't that the activated imprint? So 2 and 10. So 2 is the action we do, and 10 is that same action that has been activated. And dukkha is the rest, isn't it? Which is 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 11 and 12. Now, there are two other ways we can look at this. There is what is often called, we can group these into two sets of cause and effect. We can group it into what's called projecting, what is projecting and what is projected. And then we can also talk about then what is actualizing our future life and then the thing that's actualized. So what is projecting our future life? Is the first three links, 1, 2, and 3. The ignorance, and then the actions that come from that ignorance, which are deposited on the consciousness. So that is what's going to project another life. And then what is projected, of course, is the another life, which is link 4, 5, 6, and 7. What actualizes the next life, of course, is the craving and the grasping. That's what actualizes, causes the next life to come about. So actualizing is 8 and 9. Well, actually 10 as well, because it's the imprint that's activated. And so then that is actualizing the next life, and then what is actualized, of course, is birth, aging, and death, 11 and 12. So we can actualize, if I can spell right. It's just not so good. Actualizing, actualized. So you can group them in this way as well. That can be helpful. And then how this whole link cycle works is what we can understand, and that's going to come in the next presentation now, is that there are many of these cycles concurrently. For example, the life we have now is the end of a particular cycle. It's the actualized. So the life we have now is the end of a particular cycle. But also in this very same life, we are projecting, we are creating causes for other life. We're beginning a new cycle, maybe many of them. And also in this life, as we're approaching death, of course, we are activating the cycle for the next life, which has already begun. So how that looks, we can do the following presentation that may be useful. And we can do it in terms of how many lives do we need for a one cycle to from start to end. So we can do this in two ways, but I'll do the sort of simpler way first, and then we'll explain. So in a past life, of course, the beginning of the process is there was ignorance. That ignorance resulted in some action being done, and that action was deposited as an imprint on the consciousness. So sometime in the past, maybe in a past life, we had the first three parts of one cycle beginning. So link one, two, and three. So that means that in a past life, there's an imprint being put on the mind. Then in the present life, then as we are approaching death, then that imprint that was put on our mind stream in some earlier life, we activate it as we're approaching death. So of course that's link 8 and 9. And 10, of course, the activated. Then, of course, that activated imprint in the future life will lead to the result. The next life. And so, of course, the result is 4, 5, 6, 7, 10, 11, 12. So, here we can see, of course, 4, 5, 6, 7 is simultaneous with 11, 12. But they're referring to the next life. So in a past life, we did an action. In the present life, as we approach death, we activate that imprint. And then we end up with the next life. It's also, of course, possible that in this very life, we do an action that we will activate at the time of death. So the whole cycle could, in theory, happen over just two lives. We do the action in this life. That action we do in this life is activated at the time of death, and that results in the next life. But it could be also that the imprint that we're activating at the end of this life, we could have done the action sometime in some past lives. It's not necessary that whatever is activated at this end of this life to determine the next life, it's not certain that the action was done in this life. It could have been done in a past life. So this is how one individual cycle from start to finish. So, any questions?
So there is hope.
There is hope.
Because, let's say that we've done something harmful in this life, but in a previous life we did something which was heavier and more virtuous.
Right.
That will outweigh.
Well, here, let's say we've got this balance scale here. Okay, so you're saying in this life, or you come into this life with this
hope.
Let's say you come into this life like that, but then in this life you start sort of doing this. So this is going to sort of go, yeah. So That's why there's hope, because even if it's opposite, we can always change it. So even if we know up until this point in our life we've led a very harmful life, we can change everything. You know, like example, the classic example is Milarepa. I mean, what did he do early in his life? He got upset because his extended family stole the house from his mother, so he wiped out all of his relatives. I think he killed like 30 people. And then he got to enlightenment in that life. So there's hope for us.
But there's also there's so much that we could have, so much negativity that we could have piled up from previous births. So we don't know what's sitting inside.
Correct. But the fact that you were born a human would mean that you didn't have huge amount, because you wouldn't have got to be a human.
But perhaps those particular negativities which could have led to a lower birth, lower rank rebirth, didn't get activated at that particular.
Correct. Time. But in whatever. Correct, but again, the fact that you were born human now meant that whatever life you had in the past, immediate past life, whether it was human or otherwise, you would have had to have had this balance scale at the time of death. Otherwise you wouldn't have become a human. Which means you begin this life in this balance. Otherwise you wouldn't have got to be human. Of course, in this life, if you start doing a lot of heavy negative things, this can sort of shift.
Point I'm trying to get at is this. So when purifying, when regretting things that we may have done in this life, do you think it makes sense also to add any kind of negativity that we are seeing in the world, because we could have done that in previous
lives? Yeah. I mean, what we can do, of course, the more specific we are, the better. I mean, you know, sometimes when we do this purification, it says, you know, I want to purify all negative deeds since beginningless time.
Mention them, like acts of cruelty, savagery, yeah. As animals, what we may have done.
Right, so what we can do, of course, it's good to have an expansive motivation that whatever negativities we've done that we can't remember, we want to purify. So that's good. But I think we need to be careful that we don't make it too vague and not specific, because otherwise, you know, it's like, you know, it's like the whole, it's the same with the opposite. It's like loving kindness for all sentient beings. May all sentient beings be happy. It's sort of easy to say, but then we think, well, okay, except the guy at work that really irritates me. I don't want him to be happy. You know? So if we make it too vague and not specific, then we can lose that real intention. So yes, it's good to have a very vast intention of wanting to purify all negativities, even the ones I don't remember that I've done earlier in this life or who knows when. But also I think it's good to be also very specific, because it has some impact.
Both aspects.
Sure. So I think it's, and one thing, we'll leave it there, because we can talk a lot about this. Yeah. Okay. There was some other question. Yeah.
It seems, get the feeling that to really start to appreciate the law of karma, one has to have certain, I don't know the word, in rebirth.
I think that, you know, for example, karma really is just cause and effect. And we see cause and effect operating in the physical world. And the Buddhist assertion is that there's the same principle in the mental world. You know, if you do a bad thing, you get a bad result. You do a good thing, you get a good result. So it's a similar principle than in the physical world. So, and I think intuitively we sort of appreciate that, you know, doing a bad thing is not the right thing to do. So we intuitively appreciate that. Of course, if we want to understand the whole process here, then built into that is that, of course, in here we're talking about rebirth, but I don't think we need because the idea of karma, reflecting on karma, is to inspire us to have an ethical lifestyle, yeah, in the teachings. And I don't think we need to have a belief in rebirth to adopt an ethical lifestyle, because we know, we sense that it's the right thing to do, yeah. But what I'm saying is that if we do have an understanding of karma, and we do have an appreciation of or a belief in rebirth, then that can really inspire us even more to be very careful about the things we do. But even if we don't believe in rebirth, I think we can appreciate that if we really have a harmful, negative life, we're not really going to have a very good life, because people are going to attack us. If we harm others, they'll harm us. And so this is not going to be very conducive to a meaningful life. So, you know, if we really believe there is no rebirth, then it should motivate us even more to have a meaningful, ethical life, because we've only got one chance. So let's not waste it. Let's do something useful and meaningful and beneficial with our life. And, of course, we can understand an ethical basis is necessary for that. So, again, I don't think we need to have any particular belief in rebirth or so forth to adopt an ethical lifestyle.
So far we do, but I'm just going to take like the perspective of, let's say, something.
Sure.
Someone who would say there is no rebirth at the end of this life, blank.
Sure, okay.
Someone who is coming from that perspective might say there is no consequence to my actions.
Sure, they could. Do whatever.
Why should I care? I don't
care.
Know.
Well, they maybe just don't care and do whatever they want, but I would suggest that pretty well all these people are going to have a miserable life. No? I mean, of course, if that's what they came to, but of course if they're living in a society, they're probably going to get locked up in jail because they're going against the ethical standards of that society. So there's that consequence of for sure.
No. That's coming from attachment to dukkha, basically,
no? No, that's just coming from a lack of understanding of how to have a meaningful life, that's all.
Just a question, because I'm not sure if I'm carrying properly. So, in the past, we do a good action. So, we...
You mean here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We do a good action. And, like, for example, we attend nirvana. That's possible or not? Like, we have make a good action, we are a good person, so we achieve nirvana, or maybe enlightenment.
Right, but then we're beyond all of this.
Aha.
This is karma, which is contaminated action. So this, all of this is based on ignorance. That's why that's link one. So if you achieve nirvana,
yes,
you've got rid of these 12 links.
Yeah, but you say when you come back to help the other.
Yeah, but you don't come back like this.
Oh.
This is how we're stuck in samsara. So when we talk about action here, we're talking about action motivated by mental affliction, which of course is based on ignorance. So we're talking about what's called contaminated actions. Actions contaminated by ignorance. That's what we're talking about in these 12 links. So when we achieve nirvana enlightenment, this is all wiped out. So this is how we take uncontrolled rebirth in samsara due to ignorance and mental afflictions.
And so that's when you go out, you choose.
Well, there's a couple of terms here that's used. First one is rebirth, and this is what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
This is rebirth. Rebirth means we are cycling in this samsara. We have no choice about where we go. Where we go depends on what we've done with our life. An imprint's activated, and that's where we end up. So that's rebirth. Then as we work on the spiritual path, particularly when we have this direct realization of emptiness, that is wiping out ignorance. At that point, at least, that's burned these imprints for rebirth. So someone who's on the Mahayana path has achieved path of seeing. That never happens anymore. They have reincarnation. Reincarnation means that we can direct where we go. So we're not sort of thrown there depending on what we've done in our life. But now, because we've had that realization of emptiness, we've burnt those imprints. Now, particularly on the Mahayana path, through bodhicitta motivation, we can direct where we want to go in the next life. So we're not going through this in this way. Yeah?
Okay.
So that's technically how usually the word reincarnation is used. But of course, in our English language, people use this to mean this. Yeah. You know, reincarnation, you know. But technically, to reincarnate implies some ability to choose. That technically.
And when that happens,
then, so we're still in samsara.
Okay.
But we now advanced, we can sort of navigate. Then when we get out of samsara and achieve enlightenment, then it's called usually emanation. Meaning we appear in the world to benefit others.
Okay.
We're not in samsara anymore. So both of these is samsara.
So in emanation, we are already
enlightened.
Enlightened.
Yeah. And so then an enlightened being would appear again in the world, but they wouldn't say an enlightened being is reborn. They wouldn't use that terminology. The enlightened being would come back into the world, and usually the term used there is emanation, to distinguish from uncontrolled rebirth.
But did he know that?
Yeah, sure. If you're enlightened, you know. If there's some doubt, you're not.
But she didn't know it. As her lama that like appeared afterwards. So how can you know, if you're in connection, how are you able to know that?
Again, these days this word is used very loosely. I'm giving you the precise meaning of it. Yeah, but
reincarnation.
Right, but if in that case, it doesn't necessarily mean that that person has realized emptiness directly. That, it just means that they're able, and so they use that word as well, reincarnation, when they manage to trace someone.
Yeah.
But what I'm suggesting is that here, more specifically, we're talking about someone who has the ability to control. So when they recognize that someone else has come from this life, and they say they are reincarnated, that word does not imply that that person had control to find the next life. So what I'm suggesting is that the word reincarnation is used very loosely these days. I'm trying to sort of nail down a more precise meaning of the word. So again, when you're suggesting that, oh, this person is a reincarnation of this person, that is used in a very sort of loose way.
Yes,
that word. Because we also say that we will be reincarnated. And we're using that word this way.
But I'm talking about specific, like, people who have been identified. But the thing is that the fact that they are identified makes them, I mean, would they know that they are, like, you know...
I think it's possible. I think it's possible if you're a third person who's advanced on the spiritual path, it could be possible if you were advanced that you could pick an ordinary person and identify their previous life and say that you came from this life.
Yeah, but the person itself, you understand? Like,
yeah. But they won't remember anything.
Identify, yeah. So how would that help to go back? You see, I'm a bit... Because they can choose the way to go back, you know, where to go back. They can go back to our world. But if they don't know who they are, so...
Well, then they're not like this. That's what I'm saying. What you're explaining is that there's a third person who's saying, oh, this person here in their previous life was this person.
No, but the person himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, you come back, I understand. You come back, you burn like a baby, and you are reincarnation, but you don't remember that.
Reincarnation, or you mean someone who's told you you've been?
You
will know when the brain is fully developed. You know.
Okay, that's okay.
You know.
Yeah, like you feel it, like what Zimbano felt, that she had to go there.
But again, you know, in her case, again, I don't want to be specific.
She doesn't say that she is, but
no, but again, even way before this,
yeah.
You know, we're talking on the. We can be very advanced practitioners way before this. And so the thing is, if someone is an advanced practitioner, even before this stage, and if in a society someone else can identify where this person has ended up in the next life, then in the Tibetan system, this person is called Rinpoche, because Rinpoche means precious one. Meaning, if they can identify that this baby was in their previous life some quite qualified spiritual practitioner, it means that they have a lot of imprints in their mind for practice. So if they can get this baby and give it very good conditions when it grows up, then, and when it becomes fully developed in the brain as a teenager, they can then very quickly continue on where they left off. Of course, if they don't catch them as a baby and they happen to end up in not a good environment, those imprints could get weakened by negative influences. That's why they try to find these people to give them good conditions as a young child,
yeah.
So that they can continue on where they left off.
But it's also a risk.
That's Rinpoche.
Hmm? It's also a risk, Sokan, to like do the reincarnation.
Risk.
Because if they don't get you don't get identified.
Yeah.
So you can end up, you know, not...
Yeah, but at least you begin with good imprints.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, depending on what or not conditions you find yourself in, will... I mean, if you happen to find yourself in good conditions, then of course you'll continue on anyway.
Mm-hmm. And you of say course. Emanation is like when they find that's Lama.
No, again, Lama... Again, I think the word Lama these days is used very loosely.
Okay.
Sometimes it's used... just as a sign of respect. It technically it's a translation of the Sanskrit word guru. So technically lama means someone who's a qualified teacher of tantra, Vajrayana. But just because someone's called lama this and lama that, we shouldn't assume they're a qualified teacher of tantra. We need to check them out. Again, what we need to be careful about is that even though these words have specific meanings, these days often these words are used very loosely. And we shouldn't automatically assume anything.
Can I just ask one more question?
Sure.
About reincarnation, you come back and you, for example, achieve nirvana, and after that then you're going to achieve enlightenment. Are you dying directly?
That's still to come in the Heart Sutra. That's the next section which we're going to look at tomorrow morning.